today, raising rates into a recession. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of those posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Friday afternoon again, and Tarek Brooker's with me. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
I'm pretty good. How are you going?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. There's a lot to keep up with.
There is a lot going on, isn't there? And I don't know whether you followed the Bank of England overnight, but the governor there, I felt he's a bit like Eeyore. Right. He was sitting there looking very, very morose, saying it's not looking very good. You know, inflation peaking at more than 13%, recession for at least a year, you know, wages growth going backwards, unemployment rising. It's all going terribly wrong.
It is. I mean, I think someone else come out shortly after that and said it would be the longest drop in living standards for the British people since the Second World War, which is just an absolutely startling fact, considering, you know, where we stood, you know, not all that long ago with, you know, booming economies and everything like that on the back of all this stimulus. But, you know, all good things must come to an end.
Well, it's very interesting how he sheeted a lot of it to the gas price and energy prices. You know, he basically said, if it hadn't been for that, everything would be fine, right? Now, I have a theory that that's rather convenient, but I'm not sure that's totally the truth. Well, they also did admit that some of the inflation was now wages pressure. But you've got to ask, all that quantitative easing, you know, all of that stuff they did over the last couple of years, was that part of the problem too?
Well, the ironic thing is that, you know, in a lot of their own papers, they admit that it is a driver of inflation. They admit that QE drives inflation through higher asset prices. And the wealth effect, you know, which became, you know, one of the most favoured things of central bankers in the sort of particularly during the latter half of the 2010s. So really, when you look at it, and okay, under more normal circumstances, you're only going to see housing prices rise, you know, sort of 5, 8, 9%, you know, sort of normal, but still well above where they should be levels, you know, based on where incomes are going. But we've seen, you know, a lot more than that. You've seen, you know, 15, 20, 30 plus percent in some places. And of course, that's encouraged people to get out there and spend. And it's, you know, injected all this extra cash into the economy.
Absolutely. Well, one of the other interesting things about the UK was that they're basically saying consumers are going to spend a lot less. And that's one of the reasons why they're forecasting a recession, you know, a significant drop in people's ability to spend, simply because, as you say, they don't have the money anymore.
No, well, exactly. I mean, they're talking about the amount being spent on gas and electricity bills rising something like 12-fold. Or yep. It's absolutely nuts. You know, it just goes to show, you know, in a lot of ways, what we've been talking about over the last few months, which is that inflation is the killer. It is the thing that will ultimately, you know, undermine economies.
Yes, and it's remarkable how people are beginning to wake up to just how significant this can be. And this is why, of course, central banks are wrestling with inflation, but they caused part of the problem in the first place, I think. But it is, they've got a really convenient alibi now, because they can say, well, it's all to do with energy prices. But the interesting thing about what Andrew Bailey said, he said it 3 or 4 times, it's going to hit the least able to cope the most, you know, the less affluent, those with no savings. He kept saying it. I'm thinking, yeah, but that doesn't help. I mean, it's just underscoring the underlying issue. But what is going to be done about it? Because there are many people, there are millions of people in the UK now who just won't know what to do.
No, and the thing with Australia is, like, while we don't have the same level of gas price issue, at least not yet. I mean, I know you and the guys from Macro Business have been doing some great coverage on that. But even just based on where, you know, the RBA and Treasury forecasts are going for inflation, you know, 8% inflation is going to be an absolute handful. And, you know, now looking at their forecasts, they're forecasting, you know, declining real household outcomes for years and years to come, which is, you know, and not only that, but they're known for their optimistic forecasts. So if it ends up coming in, you know, weaker than they suggest, which it normally does, well, it's not going to be great.
Well, I think Phil Lowe should take a dose of Eeyore too, right? Because I think what we need now is some truth. And, you know, I have to say that I think Bailey did a reasonable job of actually telling it as it is which is probably pretty rare amongst central bankers, because, as you say, most of them have a whole dose of hopium.
Well, you know, we've seen from the Fed recently, they've already had two quarters of negative growth, but they're saying, no, this is not a recession. Despite the fact that every time there has been two quarters of negative growth in US history, there has been a recession as defined by the other definition from the National Bureau of Economic Research.
Well, as you know, the idea is you redefine things like CPI, right? If a CPI is not going that direction, redefine it. That's the way to solve it.
Yeah, well, you know, it worked for so many things during the pandemic. They're just like, well, why not? We'll redefine this and we'll redefine that, and everything will be hunky dory. You know, you won't have anything, but we'll tell you it's great.
But it was interesting, finally, before we get into your slides, that some of the members of the press, and it was an hour's press conference, right? And they were actually able to ask quite probing questions. It's so different from the environment here in Australia, where Phil Lowe hardly gets any real discussion or any real questions. And even when he does occasionally turn up for a press conference, they're all very contained and very narrow. You know, a couple of them did ask, you know, how does lifting interest rates control rising gas prices? Because it's beyond your control. You just said it, which is a very interesting point. You know, the fact is they're pulling a lever, but it's not necessarily connected to the underlying reason that they're giving for why inflation's so high.
But that's the thing with monetary policy. You know, we've seen the other side of monetary policy ever since the financial crisis, whereby they just kept on pulling the lever, lowering rates in the hope of generating inflation, or at least that's the official story. And now we're seeing the other side of the coin, where they're just pulling the lever, trying to get inflation down. And it is absolutely a blunt instrument, and there are probably theoretically better ways to go about it. So, for example, you know, here in Australia, we're seeing the more affluent continuing to spend. So if you looked at it purely from a mechanical perspective, of course, you could go, well, raise taxes on the wealthy. You know, right, you know, you could implement any number of things through decrease their spending, but those things are not politically viable. You know, it's much, much easier just to impose the pain on the minority in exactly the same way as we impose, you know, as they impose the pain on the people who weren't homeowners during the last decade and a bit.
Yeah, and again, I see it in my surveys that those least able to bear it are actually the ones that are actually feeling the pressure here in Australia already. So it is, pretty wacky. Anyway, we get on the slides, because otherwise we're going to run out of time. And of course, you start with another of those wonderful cartoons. They are brilliant.
I do. I really do enjoy them. As usual, the charts will be available at avidcom.substack.com. And I also just want to just take a moment to say thank you for everyone who has subscribed and donated. It is immensely appreciated. And without further ado, we'll get into the slides. Now, quite a few people recently have asked me for these housing price comparisons, but including other cities besides Melbourne and Sydney. So that's what I've done here today. I've put together this is of major New Zealand markets, Auckland, Wellington nationally, and then for Australia, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth, and Adelaide. And basically just comparing them, how they're faring in terms of 2 months before rate cuts until now. So this is up to date for the end of July. For Australia, naturally, obviously New Zealand's far ahead, but, you know, just for the purposes of comparison. And you can see that, you know, Australian markets, particularly Sydney and Melbourne, and even just nationally, are performing far, far worse than their New Zealand counterparts. Only really Adelaide is performing as well as Auckland and the other New Zealand cities were when rates rose. But it just goes to show that the Australian market is far weaker than the Kiwi market was at this point in the rate rise cycle.
Yeah, and that's just important to say. You've started from the point at when they started moving, right? And how quickly then prices started to decay. And I guess it's because of the over leverage, or the greater leverage, in Sydney and Melbourne. But actually, leverage is pretty high in New Zealand too. So it does show you that we're actually looking down the barrel of a significant drop in prices.
Indeed. And I think that, I mean, like, you know, in a lot of ways, Auckland is arguably even more over leveraged than Sydney or Melbourne on a lot of different metrics. So I think, I mean, in some ways, it may just be the fact that Australia had already reached large its zenith in terms of peak prices in these more expensive markets. you know, and we were already seeing, you know, activity start to sort of fall away. And just in the fact that obviously the RBA hiked rates, what was it, 8 months later than the Reserve Bank of New Zealand.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is worth noting that, you know, unlike some of the indices, there's a lot of indications that, in fact, prices in Sydney and Melbourne were decaying from about October last year. Right?
That's interesting.
Actually before the first rate hike. So there was already weakness creeping into the market. So that's perhaps another reason we were actually further over the cliff before we got the rate rise.
Yeah, quite possibly. Now, I quite like this because there's this idea that, you know, you raise interest rates, housing prices, you know, crash, which they basically are in parts of New Zealand, and it's going to be the end of the world for the labour market. It's going to be the end of the world for the economy. But in New Zealand, we now have 9 months worth of data that shows that it isn't. That it isn't the end of the world, at least not straight away. I mean, according to the latest unemployment data from New Zealand, unemployment rose by 0.1%. But if you actually look into the numbers themselves, only about 2,000 jobs were lost, and the underutilization rate actually dropped. So it's basically statistical noise bouncing along at the lowest unemployment rate in decades. So I really don't think that this whole idea that rates are going to rise and then everything's going to immediately fall apart is realistic.
No, and interestingly, that raises another question, of course, and the economists in New Zealand are now predicting a cash rate of 4% in New Zealand because they're saying these numbers give justification to the Reserve Bank of New Zealand moving again.
Yeah, exactly. And the stronger the labour market remains, the more they're going to raise rates. Yep. So, you know, that's really the paradox going forward, because those are really the two key mandates for the RBA and for a lot of central banks around the world. It's about employment. And it's about, you know, price stability, or aka fighting inflation. So if they can keep unemployment low and raise rates and keep unemployment relatively low, then that's a win-win from their perspective.
Absolutely. And I'll make one other point. In the UK, he was asked specifically about to what extent the rate rises might be influenced by what might happen to the exchange rate. And they said in the UK, no, the exchange rate follows rather than leads. We do look at it, but it actually is about the inflation rate and interest rates that are the two key levers. I think that's true also here in Australia and in New Zealand as well. So whilst the exchange rate might be something that everyone looks at, it's not the critical discriminator. It's this stuff.
Yeah. I would say that it does affect, you know, maybe it does affect, say, for example, the amplitude, the size of rate hikes, because, you know, the pound declined. And we saw them raise rates instead of from the 25 basis points that they were looking at before, they chose 50 basis points because, you know, and that is arguably, you know, part of the weaker pound is arguably part of that. And I mean, I think we could even say here in Australia, I don't think it's going to change the sort of direction of rate hikes per se, but it could make the RBA more aggressive if we do start to see the dollar really, really tank as it has in the past when we've seen global recessions.
Now, good point. Absolutely. Well, you know, there is all, everything's connected, but it's interesting how central bankers explain how they think about it. So, you know, to an extent that they do explain it. It's just a mystery, you know, it's just a mystery.
Well, that's it. That's it. I mean, it's all economic voodoo in a lot of ways, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. Now, this is one for our Canadian viewers. Canadian housing prices in the Toronto market are down 13% since their peak in March on a median basis. On an average basis, which is obviously, you know, all the usual disclaimers, you know, the average sale price is down over $500,000 to levels consistent with 2020. So, you know, you are seeing the makeup of the market change as prices fall. And that, you know, even, you know, perhaps the more affluent in Canada aren't transacting in the same way that they perhaps are here in Australia, where we've seen average loan sizes hold up remarkably well against rising rates so far.
But it is interesting. You make a very important point about, you know, the average versus the median, right? Because if you have a change in the mix of the types of transactions, that translates then through to some different indices and how they're actually behaving. But is it interesting in Australia, we got data this week from Mr. Joy showing that, in fact, the top end of the market is dropping the fastest now.
Yep. Well, that's what's interesting. I mean, you've seen the similar things even from, well, who was it, Domain the other day, you know, talking about, you know, some suburbs losing, you know, $250,000 worth of value in, a, you know, in 3 months.
Exactly.
So, yep. you know, it's certainly getting interesting out there. And, you know, I mean, and then there's obviously the age old debate that, you know, between, you know, you and Edwin and some of the indices about the lag in the data.
Yeah. Well, lags are quite interesting. We still think that the real numbers are probably worse than the ones coming through in the indices, but we'll see. I mean, the indices are going down, so, and the rate of acceleration is increasing down, and it's spreading. So even Adelaide now is looking at wobbly too. So I think you can assume that all markets across Australia will continue to slide, and I think Toronto gives us a good lever as to, you know, where it could end up.
Well, I mean, you know, not particularly on that point, but just on the size of price falls. I mean, you've even got someone like Shane Oliver, who's usually a sort of glass half full sort of guy, talking about potentially Sydney prices falling later in the year by 4% in a month. And, you know, I mean, that's exactly what we're seeing in Toronto. So perhaps we're not all that different.
No, of course, Mr. Oliver is not thinking that rates will go up as high as ANZ, for example. But, you know, we'll see. It's going to be a 2 rather than a 3. So we'll be able to see that in a few weeks, won't we?
Yeah, well, it's certainly getting interesting out there. Okay, now we get to the RBA's wage growth forecast. Now, the one on the left is from Alex Joyner on Twitter, who posted some great graphs today on the various RBA forecasts. And basically, it shows where real wages are going to go in terms of, you know, the RBA's inflation forecast and the RBA's wage growth forecast, which, as you can see from on the right there, have been rather heroic in the past. Now, basically, by sort of the end of 2023 into 2024, Australian wages in real terms are going to be roughly where they were in 2009. So we would have wiped out about, you know, 13 years worth of wages growth by that point. So, you know, I think this is a perfect example of why inflation shouldn't be left to get out of control in the first place.
And make the other point, of course, the index is an average again, right? What we do know, if you look carefully across industries and across different types of socio-demographic groups, there are some still doing quite well with quite strong wage growth, but others, particularly in some of the public sector, as health workers, for example, you know, they're going backwards even faster. So this is a really important thing. And you're right. Inflation is, it grinds people into the ground, doesn't it? Because basically it means you just buy less and less and less. And the chances of wages catching up, even the latest stable monetary policy is suggesting a couple of years before you see any real wages growth. And they're, as you say, heroic at best.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, real wages starting to actually pick up in a meaningful way around 2025,
yep.
You know, which is so far away that, you know, and there's so many variables that any sort of forecast from then is obviously going to be wrong, you know, whether it's to the upside or whether it's to the downside. And if you look particularly at that graph on the left between, say, 2013 and 2019, the wage growth is actually relatively minimal in real terms. So if we resume at pre-pandemic rates of wage growth, it is going to be a very, very long time before, I mean, there could literally be a child born in the next year who won't see 2019 levels of purchasing power until they're an adult. You know, that is well and truly a potential on the table, you know, especially if it is an inflationary future.
Yeah, absolutely right. Well, wage growth, you know, and real take-home pay, which is the other way to think about it, is a real issue. And what I'm seeing in my surveys is that people are trying to work additional jobs to try and up their overall income. So more people grabbing an extra job or two on the side, you know, just to try and make a few more hours. Because the only way to solve this, if wages aren't growing, you know, per hour at work, you've got to work more hours. And the best way to work more hours is to either do overtime or find another job or two. And
ironically, I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to see some heroic announcements about job creation and going, yes, it's all going so well.
Exactly. And interestingly, you know, that Western Sydney is an example where there's a lot of mortgage stress. Well, there, the number of people who've got an additional job now compared with 3 or 6 months ago is significant. So there's a correlation between those in stressed environments. And they're just grabbing whatever they can. They'll do almost anything just to get a few more hours doing whatever it takes. I mean, this is the sort of scenario that really worries me from a social and economic perspective, but more importantly, from a social perspective.
No, I agree, and I think that that is why, we are going to see them fight inflation, because it is that existential threat, it is that social threat, and the reality is unemployment is so low that even if you do see unemployment rise by, say, I don't know, say 1.5%, we're basically where unemployment was when the pandemic started. So, there is so much scope for them to raise rates from a labor market perspective, that I don't really see any reason for them not to. I mean, and that's part of why we're seeing, say, for example, even in the UK, where things are, much, much worse than they are here, that they're raising rates into a recession, knowing full well what's going to happen, knowing full well that it's going to damage the labor market, but they don't have any choice.
That's right. And then the other lever here will be migration. They'll pull the lever even harder to get more people in because they need to fill those jobs. And of course, that also has a little bit of supportive impact on home prices too, which could be convenient for the incumbent government.
Well, let's just hope that they follow the example of the Hawke and Keating governments back in the early to mid 90s, where immigration basically fell off a cliff, because they saw what was going on with the labor market, they saw what was going on with unemployment, and then you saw the immigration come down significantly. But I mean, it's a different time now, whether or not, I mean, I hope. But I'm not too optimistic.
Funny that.
Yeah. Okay. Now this is the RBA's various forecasts on the left. It's a table from their latest statement. And on the right there, we've got another one from Alex Joyner, basically showing where the trimmed mean, which is basically sort of Australia's attempt at a core CPI reading, is going to go. And it's basically just strips out the more volatile items and those types of things. And basically it just shows that they're not expecting to return to the target band until at least 2025. So if that's correct, they're setting up quite a bit of a showdown with the market, because the market's expecting rates to start to come down towards the second half of 2023 and early in 2024. But if the RBA is right, and that's a strange thing to say, but if they are right, that basically means that there's no scope to cut rates for until at least 2025.
Yeah, and I suspect the argument will be that the peak shock from inflation, which includes, of course, the gas prices, will actually drop out because of the base effect, right? But the question that nobody's got an answer to is to what extent will the second order impacts, are they already embedded? In other words, will wages start to climb or will other costs continue to rise? And it's interesting that there still seems to be quite a lot of capacity from companies to put their prices up and people still pay them. So
Yeah, ex exactly.
I have this theory that, in fact, it is not as simple as their chart shows. And this inflation hangover will go on for a lot longer and will be a much, much more significant. I think that the UK's probably got a clearer view as to what may play out. But even there, they're suggesting that the energy shock will pass through because they're assuming energy prices are going to settle at a high bar, but they're not going to keep rising because it's the rate of change, of course, which is the critical thing in these numbers. But just remember, folks, that it can be not changing, but at a much higher level. So you're still paying a lot more of your income each month on gas or whatever it is, right? And that doesn't mean you're any better off.
No, I agree, and I think that, I mean, my personal theory in all of this is that we're going to see a yo-yo in terms of inflation. That we're going to see inflation, rise, and it's going to hit a peak at some point. And maybe it has already hit its peak. Maybe the peak still lays ahead. It's literally the multi-trillion dollar question. But say hypothetically, we do see a peak in commodity prices. We do see a peak in energy prices, say before the end of the year, and then, inflation starts to come down. But the question is, what's happening with core inflation? What's happening with that inflation within the economy that isn't impacted by commodity prices? It's driven by wages. It's driven by rising domestic costs. Things like services inflation, for example, which in the US is running at high enough level on its own to justify rate hikes. And then you've got the opposite outside of the base effect argument. So say hypothetically, energy prices do fall, prior to the end of the year. And then next year, you see some stimulus, you start to see the supply demand imbalance take over again. And then you're right. And then all of a sudden, 6 months later, you're right back where you we're right back where we started.
Yep.
So that is my concern, that we're going to see central bankers and politicians in particular declare victory early and then pump too much stimulus back into it as the sort of recession becomes clear.
Absolutely. As you say, the yo-yo, you know, deflation, inflation, it's all in play. I mean, the other point, that chart that you showed, conveniently, inflation comes down just around the time of the next election.
Well, you know, that's a nice little thing for Albo, isn't it? I mean, I honestly, you know, if things do go completely pear-shaped, as some people are saying, if we do see, you know, like what Shane Oliver said was possible, 4% price falls in Sydney and everything goes completely down the toilet, that's not necessarily, I mean, yes, obviously he's going to get smashed in the polls in the meantime and there's going to be a lot of unhappy people. But if all this happens relatively soon, you could see a nice little recovery before the middle of 2025, because that's still a long, long way away.
Yeah, it's time enough, isn't it? We'll see.
Yeah, well, I mean, then he can pump the bubble right from the start all over again, and everyone will be like, "Oh, my house price is up 20% this year again."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. We can do last year again.
Yeah, well, exactly. This is what I was referring to regarding the sort of inflationary pressures becoming entrenched, because we're starting to see selling prices for the services sector reaching, you know, multi-decade highs based on the trend figure. And we're seeing, you know, a similar thing with input prices. So, you know, while there are a lot of people talking about peak inflation, about, you know, they're sort of all falling away, it's going to take time. And we are at a very, very high level in relative terms, and even in terms of, you know, the previous inputs we saw in, say, like 2008.
Well, the interesting question for me is input costs are definitely going up. But if you look at where end prices are now, they're hitting the shops, they're a lot higher than those input costs would justify, right? So look at some of the food cost rises in some of the supermarkets or some of the gas costs and prices. There's more going on here than just a direct transference of input costs to increasing prices. I have a theory that corporates are quite quietly just putting the price up a little more to create a little bit more margin. Maybe it's equivalent to the banks passing on all of the increase rates for mortgage holders, but not passing on all to depositors, creating a bit of extra margin. So expect to see profits from corporates actually rising.
Well, that's quite possible. I mean, I think on the other side of the coin, you're with small businesses. You've seen people who have been reticent to raise costs, who have been hopeful that the transitory narrative has been true. I mean, like for example, I was at my local kebab shop the other day, and you know he hadn't raised prices in 18 months, and he recently raised them by about a little over 10%. And I mean, it's perfectly understandable. He has seen his costs rise by that much, but for those who are reticent to raise prices, those price increases are going to continue to feed in over time. And I think that there is going to be that lag in the data and in reality. I mean, even say, for example, with rents, you know, if you saw the full 16% increase priced in SQM's capital city rents priced into the CPI, well, the CPI would be like 0.7, 0.8% higher year on year.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing about the rents, of course, is the way the ABS does it. It's everybody's rent, not just the new rents, right? Whereas the SQM one is more new rent. So there's a difference there. But it does suggest to me that the rental costs will be significantly higher ahead, and that's now another force on inflation.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. It's, you know, you're absolutely right, you know, regarding, you know, they're two different things. But, you know, as those new rents do feed in, as you know more rents are raised over time, that could become a really challenging entrenched part of inflation, despite the fact that you're only talking about something that represents maybe, I think it's about 6% of the overall CPI, but that could be driving, you know, sort of 0.5 0.6% CPI year on year well into the future, and create, you know, a more entrenched inflationary impulse, which could create some real problems for the RBA and for people more broadly.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking a bit sticky.
Okay, now this is something I'm putting together for an article based on, you know, how, you know, because a lot of people are saying even at 1.35%, you know, they're just like, I can't afford my mortgage. You know, things are getting out of hand already. And even more people are saying that since the RBA raised the cash rate to 1.85%. Now, based on the RBA's numbers of the average rate payable, that means that the average mortgage rate is about 4.25% based on how much rates have risen. Now, as you can see, you can, you know, based on the debt to income ratio that these borrowers borrowed at, that even a prudent borrower who borrowed 5.5 times their household income is, you know, which is below APRA's definition of high debt to income, which is 6 times household income, they are today now technically in mortgage stress, in technical mortgage stress, not Martin's definition based on cash flow, but they are expending more than 30% of their household income on their mortgage.
Right. And the point there is you're using the gross definition, right? The gross.
Yes.
Gross income. I mean, there's a big debate about whether that's the gross one is right one, or whether you're looking at the income after tax, for example, right?
Yeah.
Because of course, if you think about it, the tax goes off the top. So there's another little thing to think about there. But this chart is really, really concerning. Remember, there are people in Sydney and Melbourne who've got 8 times, 9 times, 10 times income,
right? Yeah.
In the last couple of years, because of the very loose lending, and they are leveraged to the hilt, you know. And if you really are putting 50, 51, 52% of your gross income, that's everything, just to pay the mortgage, that's horrendous.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, it's just not. I mean, you're basically talking about anyone who was, you know, who borrowed at a high, you know, debt to income ratio, even people who borrowed at a lower debt to income ratio, at say, you know, say for example, rates do get to say 6%, which is a 3.5%, roughly sort of 3.5% cash rate. You're talking about even people who are relatively prudent consuming 40% of their gross income on their mortgage, and that is just, you know, that is a startling number.
Yep.
You know, and I mean, the ridiculous thing is up until, you know, sort of the middle of 2019, these people were apparently stress tested on 7.25%. Now you can look, and these people were given 8 times loans. So you're talking about almost 2/3 of your income being consumed on your mortgage. Yep. And that was apparently A-OK. So I.
Well, and remember, a lot of the discussion about serviceability of mortgages only thought about paying the interest element. They didn't actually think about the capital repayment element, right? Interestingly. So all of those people who were saying, well, of course, interest rates are really low, so therefore interest costs are much lower. Yeah, but you've still got to pay back the capital.
Well, that's what I think is just really interesting about this chart, because if you look at someone who borrowed, you know, say 8 times household income at, you know, relatively recently, maybe they've got a 3-year fixed loan at, say, 1.9%, right, or 2%. That was only consuming 35% of their income. Now, don't get me wrong, that is a challenging thing to deal with, but it's doable. You know, you make some sacrifices, you tighten your belt, it's a doable thing. But that person at, say, you know, after, say, the next 50 basis point rise, which is sort of, you know, universally accepted, they're paying 50% of the household income on that, their gross household income. And they are, I mean, you know, there's no other way to put it. They're up the creek, you know, without a paddle.
Absolutely right. And the point there is that, again, I see it in my surveys, what people start doing is because they want to pay their mortgage, they know they need to pay their mortgage, so they cut elsewhere, right? So they spend less at the shops and they might put mail on credit cards or whatever in the short term. But if fundamentally their cash flows are now negative and they can't cover everything, this is why I use the mortgage stress definition I use in terms of cash flow, right? You can't go on doing that forever. You know, there is going to be a D-Day at some point when things are going to go really, really pear-shaped, because there's no get-out-of-jail card here in terms of low interest rates, nor indeed income growth, right? In fact, they're both going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, no, exactly. And part of the thing looking at this over time is that people have been able to just simply just go to the bank and just go, oh, well, I'm behind, or they'll, you know, I've known people who've just gone, okay, I'm just going to get a personal loan, credit card, I'll use that to pay the mortgage. Then, you know, they'll get maxed out and then they'll just go to the bank and just go, I'm just going to withdraw some more equity. I'm going to use that to pay the mortgage, you know, and, you know, pay off the credit cards that were paying off the mortgage.
Yep.
And as long as housing prices rise, people are perfectly capable of doing that for years. I know people who do that for over a decade,
yep.
You know, but once housing prices stop rising, the music stops and then people have got a problem.
And you notice the refinancing rates are going up dramatically. So the data that came out earlier this week showed that. The interesting question is, and it's not really very well disclosed in any of the APRA statistics, as to what extent Equity Mate is still actually running.
That is what I really want to know. Yeah. I mean, do you have any data on that in your own surveys?
I have some data on that, and I know that there is still a considerable number of people who are still using Equity Mate as part of the refinance even now.
Are there more now than there was before, or is it
no?
Sort
the,
of
the banks similar? The banks have tightened. They're asking a few more questions about what do you want to do with the money than previously, but nevertheless, it's still quite a proportion. I actually don't remember what the number is, but I could probably pull some data out given a bit of time, because it probably would make quite an interesting story. I think about one third is what I'm seeing. About one third of households currently are actually, when they refinance, they're taking a little bit of extra out to be able to pay off the old credit card or whatever and give themselves more leeway. Can't go on doing that when property prices are going the other way though.
No, exactly. No, I would definitely love if you could send through that data whenever, you know, whenever's good, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, okay, I'll see what I can do.
Now, this gets us to the loan buffer rates I was mentioning. There was the old 7.25%, you know, floor for basically that you were assessed as you could pay, you know, as enforced by APRA. Then APRA had the smart idea of dropping it to a 2.5% buffer because reasons. And then they changed their mind in October last year and said, oh, no, we're going to have to raise it to a 3% buffer. But I think that, I mean, households are already struggling. You know, you throw in inflation. I don't really find those buffers all that realistic when you look at that chart, to be honest.
Well, no. And the point about buffers is there's a bunch of assumptions made, right? And if you go back to the other thing, which is the expenses that people actually have, because that's the other way that people think about it. Can you afford to cover an extra amount, you know, 3% or 2.5%, right? And have you got enough to cover all your other living expenses? But if you look at the living expenses calculations that many of the banks are doing, they are way lower than reality, right? So in fact, what people have done is they've been assessed on a level of expenditure which is a lot lower than what they're actually doing. And a lot of the bank underwriting processes have not picked that up. So as well as, it's all part of the same problem, right? They haven't got enough cash coming in to do everything they want to and service the mortgage. I mean, that's the basic truth. And with rates gone up, that's going to get worse and worse. That's why the mortgage stress on my analysis is going through the roof. 45% of households now are in mortgage stress. It's bigger than it's ever been.
Yeah, and then we've got the other side of the thing, which is in the next slide, which is the number of people who are less than truthful on their loans. You know, this is from UBS, and they survey people every year, home buyers who recently took out mortgages that year. And in 2021, 41% of people admitted. So, I mean, what the actual number is, you know, you can use your imagination or whatever. Admitted to being less than factually accurate with their loan applications. And I think of those, around, I think it was about 28% overstated their income. And of those, around 26% overstated their income by more than a quarter.
Yep, absolutely. And interestingly, if you ask the question as to the channel that they actually put the loan application through, you'll find that there's a distortion towards broker-originated loans relative to branch-originated loans, interestingly.
Yeah, indeed. It's actually a really, really interesting report. I'm looking forward to the next one. We should have in a couple of months' time. And yep. If this is as endemic as these numbers suggest, it's pretty clear why people are finding themselves in difficulty so quickly now, because that either they've overstated their income or they've understated their outgoings. So, I mean, how prevalent this is that really, you know, in the eye of the beholder? I mean, because we just don't have the data to know definitively.
No, exactly. Well, we've got Hilda data from 3 years old. Well, that'll be,
that's very useful,
right? Exactly right.
Oh, yeah.
and the other point is that many households actually don't know what they spend. So about half of the households in my surveys don't know. Well, they don't keep a budget. They don't actually know what they're spending. So when you actually come to filling out your mortgage application form, if you don't know what you're spending, how do you know? What numbers do you put in? Well, you make them up, don't you?
Yeah, well, it's about this, yeah. You know, which is usually what is it usually drastically understated or somewhat overstated? That's what I wonder.
Mostly it's understated because, of course, they know that they don't want to, get over those ratios. But the truth is that this whole expenditure side of mortgage underwriting has been, well, rubbish for years. You know, the Royal Commission highlighted all those issues and nothing was done. And then, of course, ASIC sort of got very weak at it and really hasn't done much about it. And so this is now coming home to roost. So this is why this is so critical for people to understand, that we are now in the scenario which a lot of people never thought we would see, where rates are going up, where some of the tide is going out, as it were, and now you're seeing who is actually swimming naked, to quote Warren Buffett.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay, now there is this sort of idea that central banks want that they will one day abandon inflation targeting because they need to protect equity markets. Now, this has never really sat all that well with me personally, because you know, inflation is the killer of societies. You know, it's equity market drawdowns are legion. They've happened, you know, so many times in history, and very, very rarely do they lead to something, you know, approaching the level of challenge that inflation can create for the cohesion of a society. And this is taken from mid-June, from when we were starting to see this big run-up in bond yields, and it basically just shows how wealth was destroyed by rising inflation, you know, by the fact that the bond market, you know, just saw, you know, inflation just further playing out. And that, I think, is one of the really, really key issues in all of this, because all of what we're seeing at the moment, you know, whether it's from central banks or whether it's from markets, is predicated on inflation getting under control. But if it doesn't, if this recession that the market thinks that we're going to have doesn't result in the level of inflation destruction that we're seeing, we could see further wealth destruction, in the bond sector.
Yeah, well, not just that. I mean, look at crypto, right? Another example of wealth destruction, you know, or wealth disruption, I would say, as well.
Yeah, I just think it's a really, really complex issue, and it's easy to just go, oh, but the stock market. It's like, yes, but the stock market is only a fraction of global wealth.
Right.
There are other things and other things that will be disrupted, you know, by letting inflation run.
And it's just worth reflecting on the distribution of that wealth destruction as well.
Well, exactly. You're going to look after your mates, aren't you? You're going to look after your mates. You're going to look after the hedge funds that hold these, you know, tens of trillions of dollars of bonds. They're the people. I mean, you know, the system is run, you know, to benefit those people. They are the people who are the political donors. They are the people with the leverage. And while they may not be happy about a stock market drawdown, and while they'd be much rather if they just, you know, they kept the spigot open and everything running, at the end of the day, you know, I mean, look at, you know, 2008. Yeah, people got caned, but for those people who went to cash, or those people who had some cash on the sidelines, it was a generational buying opportunity. So for them, they don't really care.
Absolutely. And in fact, some of the professional investors, you know, those who actually are meant to be more savvy, are still out of the market at the moment. They still believe that the current uptick in terms of the stock markets around the world is temporary and it's going to come down again, right? And so they're saying, well, you know, I can take the longer term view. And in fact, quite a lot of the people who've gone back in have been those, more recent market entrants who perhaps have less experience. So it'll be interesting to see. And it's just going back, if you go back to the, the Great Depression, you know, back then, it was very interesting that a lot of the more affluent people were still able to navigate their way around it. It was the mass affluent who lost their shirts left, right, and center.
I think that we're seeing, you know, sort of just the culmination of years and years of monetary policy, of just the normality of the wealthy getting wealthier, and that sort of being the status quo. And I think that people are just expecting that to continue. But I don't think they're expecting it to continue in the same way, rather than seeing that things could play out quite a bit differently and the wealthy could still come out on top.
Oh, I think they probably will. They tend to have more options and they tend to have more advisors, all of those things, right?
More connections too.
And so they often on the inside track on some of the things that are going on. And more connections with the political regime as well. I guess the other point is interesting to note to Tariq, you know, have you noticed how everyone's not talking about MMT anymore?
Yes, I have noticed that.
Funny that, right? So that experiment that, yeah, no, you can just go on printing forever and never have to pay it back. Well, that seems to have gone out the window.
Well, I mean, I do have some sympathy for the MMT advocates in that regard, because, I mean, yes, they can say, you know, this isn't proper MMT. It hasn't been conducted in the proper way. It hasn't been dedicated towards productivity-enhancing infrastructure or productivity-enhancing programs, whatever. And it also hasn't been managed on the other side of things in terms of taking the heat out of the economy once inflation did take off. But, and this is the big but, realistically, was the government, any government, ever going to be able to make those moves to take the heat out of the economy once inflation did take off from engaging in MMT policies in the first place? Now, while you might see that in certain places where you have, you know, exceptionally good governance and, you know, exceptionally engaged people, say, for example, maybe in a place with direct democracy, say like Switzerland. But in terms of places where you're buying votes using all sorts of all manner of things, from, you know, handouts to various support, excessive, shall we say, support programs, I don't really see how it's going to be realistic in a lot of different places. And I include Australia in that.
Well, I agree. And of course, the other factor here is that the cost of debt is now so much higher than it was and will continue to climb, which means, of course, that more of the government coffers has to go just directly through to servicing the debt they actually have. So, you know, big debt is now more costly than ever.
Yeah, well, we're going to see the double whammy of that as the RBA's holdings of bonds roll off as well. Right. All that debt's going to have to be refinanced, which is really going to be interesting, because you're going to see the banks having to refinance their term funding facility debts, and you're going to have to see the government refinancing all those short-term bonds that were bought by the RBA, which amounts to tens of billions of dollars. So it's going to be a very, very interesting couple of years in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the Australian bond markets are more illiquid than they were, and there's more volatility, and there's all sorts of funny things going on there. So this will be another interesting thing. So I think that, you know, the bottom line argument for all this is that the wealth destruction will probably continue in some form for quite a lot longer. It won't be equally spread. And the more you look for a sort of a way around it, the less likely it is to find it, I think, at the moment. So,
yeah, I would say that's largely correct. Now, this is relating to the issues that we're seeing in Taiwan after Nancy Pelosi's little visit. There are four US aircraft carriers in East Asia. And as you can see, of the carriers that are currently deployed, four out of the six are in East Asia. Now, admittedly, two of these are large deck amphibious assault carriers, but they have fighter aircraft aboard. But it just goes to show that the Americans are well and truly taking this issue seriously.
Yeah. Now, this is very interesting, Tariq. And of course, the whole, you know, Taiwan situation is a bit of a wake-up call to Australia, right? Because Taiwan's got 23 million residents, right? We've got 26 million, right? It just sort of puts it in a little bit of context here in terms of the relative size of the problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, thankfully for Australia, we're a whole lot further away, and, you know, we have a lot more options. But I think it just goes to show just how fragile the international status quo is. You know, we've seen, you know, the issues with the war in Ukraine completely just, you know, blow up Europe's strategy for basically everything. And, you know, if we do start to see, you know, protracted blockades or, you know, any number of things that sort of, you know, we've seen with the fire and brimstone threats from elements of Chinese state media, you know, it could very much undermine the status quo of the world.
Absolutely. And that's the point, of course, because, you know, there's so many hair triggers around, you know, the Russian situation, the China situation. And sometimes I say to people, you know, in my different scenarios, I talk about different potential futures, right? There is the sort of the Armageddon scenario where some of those things go off really badly. And that, from an economic perspective, would be absolutely disastrous, and probably from an ecological and humanitarian perspective too. I don't think I've ever known a situation where we've got so many of these different sort of forces all sort of jostling at the same time. So it's very complex.
Yeah, indeed. This is a good one. I quite like Chinese youth unemployment is basic, you know, it's higher than the Eurozone. It's more than double what it is in the United States. And this is the, not only that, but I think what makes this the most interesting is the fact that this is from the Chinese National Bureau of Statistics. This is what they're willing to admit. So I think that it's really interesting that they're actually admitting to a problem of this severity. And, you know, this is something that I explore in an article I wrote about, you know, the changing and shifting priorities of Chinese policymakers and how basically they're not just, you know, jamming stimulus into the system anymore, that it's a lot, lot more complex than just throwing money at a bridge to nowhere. I'll send you the link and I'll get you to put it in the description.
No, do that. And it's interesting because Edwin, in our Monday rant, mentions this quite often, the fact that many youngsters in China now basically have given up on an aspiration to get a decent job, you know, and their whole motivation is changing. And that's creating a huge amount of social pressures up there as well. And not to mention the mortgage holidays that are not actually there yet. And, you know, people still being forced to pay for mortgages that haven't delivered any properties. I mean, there's a bunch of issues there. But the demographic shift in China more broadly is one that's just worth thinking about for a second, because what we know is that effectively the birth rate is very much lower. We've got a very significant aging population. And in fact, if you look at what's happening in China now, and you look back to where Japan was about 20 years ago, there are some very significant similarities, economically speaking and demographically speaking. So there's some big issues in China that they've yet to address.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you've even seen in Chinese state media, they're talking about the population shrinking by, you know, sort of 2024, 2025.
Yep.
And that's what they're officially saying.
Yep.
You know, there are some demographers who believe the Chinese population started shrinking in 2018. And, you know, that sort of in some ways bears out in the way that, you know, GDP growth has become a lot harder to come by in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, even before the pandemic. So, yeah, I think that we're seeing, you know, a very interesting shift in China that, you know, that in a lot of ways may ensure that it gets old before it gets rich.
Yeah. And then the other point, of course, is if they have a falling population, you don't need so many properties.
No, and they've already got up to, I mean, some studies suggest up to 80 million men empty anyway.
Exactly, so, exactly.
You know, the great, great recipe there for a housing crash.
Yes, that's why properties are falling.
Speaking of housing crashes, not quite a housing crash, but some bank bailouts anyway. And the Chinese government has allocated 320 billion yuan in public funds to bailing out small and mid-sized regional banks. Now, the thing that I think is interesting about this isn't just the fact that it's a bank bailout, which is sort of pretty interesting in and of itself, but it's the fact that they're taking money that was slated for infrastructure and sold as an infrastructure bond to bail out the banks. And that is not a good thing for Australia, because if they're taking money that was meant to be spent on buying our iron ore and our coking coal to make steel, to make bridges, to make airports and hospitals and whatever, and they're using it to bail out their banks instead, that's less money that's flowing to us.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not the first time that they've been generous to the banking system. They've cut the equity requirements and done other things. And there's a lot of recycling of cash between developers and councils and all those things too, right? All trying to keep this this Ponzi scheme going a bit further. But this is a very significant move. I think you're absolutely right to call it out.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see how many others come forward needing help, because, you know, this is just one, you know, sort of, you know, arm of intervention, because we saw the other day there was another 300 billion yuan dedicated, which is about sort of 44 billion US dollars, dedicated to being given to commercial banks to lend to distressed property developers. Now, I don't think that the banks are actually going to lend it to the property developers, the ones who are actually really in trouble, but it just goes to show that they're actually trying to at least, I think it's more of a case of massaging the narrative for you know, sort of the uninitiated observer, rather than something that's actually going to fix the problem. And I mean, realistically, you're talking about an industry that's worth something like $6 trillion. You know, $44 billion is a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, but it's just symbolic. But I mean, I suppose the other point there, it's worth reflecting on again, those depositors who suddenly found that those deposits were now converted into investments in the bank, right? I mean, that's a sort of, you know, that's deposit bail-in by another name, and that's in China.
Yeah, well, I think that's what we're going to see at this point. I think we're going to start to see these funds slated for infrastructure, you know, these trillions and trillions bailing out these people, because that is a much larger social threat than the GDP target coming in a little bit weak this year.
Absolutely, and again, it goes back to the social consequences of that and whether people will make a fuss or not. I mean, there were pictures earlier on of, you know, people demonstrating and, you know, quite strong response. So interesting times. And once again, it's worth just underscoring how fragile the banking system is in China. It is wobbly around the edges.
Yeah, and that's just, and that's the actual banking system. You get into the shadow banking side of things, and it's just what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's big and it's hairy, and nobody quite knows how big it is, but it's certainly full of risk.
Yeah, exactly. Now, there was some relief from inflationary pressures in the US ISM services prices paid index. It fell to 72.3, which is still very, very elevated. But it did fall away from its highs for the first time in quite a while. So I think this is an interesting little note as to we may see some weakening of US inflationary pressures from their absolute peaks. But 72 is still high. It's still very high. And it's far from sort of it's all over for inflation, as some commentators are suggesting.
Well, it is interesting, Tarek, how a number of the market commentators are saying, see, we've reached the peak. It's all downhill from here, right? Despite the fact that, of course, the Fed lifted by 75 basis points and signaled they're doing something similar. But the interesting how the bond markets are definitely signaling, you know, a fall ahead, right? And now whether that's recessionary or not, or whether that's just because they believe that the Fed will have to take rates the other way, I don't know. But there's such a big contradiction here between inflation still very hot, some of the indicators quite negative. And of course, it'll be interesting to see what the latest employment numbers are when they come out next, and some of these statistics. So it's full of conflict and it's full of you know, ambiguity. So to call inflation beaten off this, I think that's a bit of a long bow.
I agree. And you make a really interesting point regarding the bond market. I think that it's pricing in something that isn't really real yet. I mean, yes, we could absolutely see, you know, a rather harsh recession, but it's not pricing in a harsh recession yet. It's pricing in inflation coming down and then rates being cut in sort of Q2 next year. And I don't really see how we get from 9% inflation to within the ballpark of 2% inflation without a hard recession to be able to be, you know, for the Fed to justify that. So, well, yeah.
So unless the base effect comes to the rescue, so if the rate of change suddenly stops and it goes back a bit, eventually those big numbers will drop out, right? So maybe the maths will save them, but that doesn't necessarily help.
Well, I mean, it's possible, but I mean, I have a hard time seeing that happen before, you know, in like, say, like the next, let's call it the next 6 to 7 months, you know, yeah. Like the base effects will be favorable in terms of energy. But the question is what is core inflation going to be? I mean, their favorite measure of inflation isn't CPI, it's core PCE, which stands for personal consumption expenditure. Yep. That's their, you know, their little baby when it comes to, you know, monitoring inflation. And that is sticky. That is very sticky. You know, it's risen and it's staying, you know, sort of roughly within that sort of 4.7 to 5.1% range, which is still very, very high.
Yep.
And that is what they monitor the most. And if that starts rising above 2%, that's when we really start to see alarm bells from the Fed. You know, like, yes, they care about the CPI because obviously it's a very politically vital thing. You know, it's what everybody talks about. But if that core PCE remains strong, even in the face of rising, you know, falling inflation because of falling energy prices or heavy discounting in goods, which is something what we've spoken about. We spoke about, I believe it was in April, about rising levels of inventory driving a deflationary impulse for retail.
Yep.
But that doesn't solve the core issue. It's just, you know, it's just base effects, and you know, that's not going to be pretty.
No, I think we're in for a very interesting ride over the next 3 to 6 months. And I suspect that we will still see inflation up there. I suspect we will see central banks continue to lift rates higher. At some point, they'll start then questioning their own judgment even more and then sort of probably pause a bit to see what happens. But it's interesting how all the central banks now who've, you know, recently made changes have said, we're going to be data dependent, right? I think that's their get out of jail card, right? So let's just see what the data does. But it is worth just reflecting on this. It takes time for rate hikes to flow through to really impact some of the metrics.
Yeah.
So if they really are going to be data dependent, they need to wait 3, 4, 5, 6 months to see what the impact of what they just did is. And they've not been anywhere close to that. They just keep pulling and pulling and pulling on the same lever every month without seeing, I think, the full consequence of what they're doing.
No, I mean, it's you know, it's like, you know, driving looking out the rearview mirror, you know. I mean, that's really central banks in a nutshell, you know. I particularly like the imagery, you know, when Homer Simpson was doing it, driving backwards, you know. But I think that realistically, you know, they're gonna keep raising rates. We may reach a point of a relative pause around, you know, maybe after the September Fed meeting, largely because the next Fed meeting is just before the US midterms. And, you know, they may not want to sort of, you know, be seen as interfering with that, or maybe they'll only go 25 basis points. But I think that at the end of the day, it's about core inflation. It's about what that's doing. And if that continues to accelerate, or if we start seeing wage spiral being embedded in the US, as some, you know, say for example, as Rabobank already says it is, yep, then they don't realistically have much choice. I mean, maybe we'll see a, you know, politically driven, you know, pause, or a politically driven sort of, you know, tapering in terms of the size of rate hikes. But, you know, it may just be back to normal next year, particularly if the Democrats, you know, win, you know, somehow make a massive come from behind victory and they can set the tone for policy going forward. Because, well, then you're going to be talking about, you know, all manner of stimulus, debt forgiveness, all these things that are just going to, you know, drive a greater than otherwise would have inflationary impulse.
Yeah, and you make a very, very critical comment there about political, right? Anybody who thinks that the central banks around the world are apolitical and are not actually influenced by the political surges that are around the place, I think are kidding themselves, right? So the Fed, Bank of England, even Phil Lowe here, they are to an extent influenced because they are part of the political process and system, whether you actually like it or not. And therefore, when they've actually are making decisions about this, you know, inflation and interest rate lever, they can't do it in isolation from the political ambience, can they?
No. And it's also about the behind the scenes stakeholders as well. You know, people who make the political donations, people who push the buttons, you know, and, you know, the influence that they have. I mean, obviously, you know, politicians, you know, they just love low rates to the moon, but, you know, there's a sort of other people beyond that who are pushing a very different agenda.
Absolutely. Large corporates, for example, those international investors, hedge funds, you know, there's a whole torrent of people, not least.
I'm sure they could all get together and say, I don't know, Davos, you know, and have a good old chat.
Exactly right. Well, of course, that's how to solve everything, isn't it? You get all the really, you know, affluent people together, the people who think they rule the world and own the world, and they decide what to do, and then they just cascade it down, and bingo. That's the way.
Exactly. Distill the message. Eat the bugs.
Exactly right. Eat the bugs. But you'll own nothing and be happy. Great.
Yeah. I'm sure that'll work in a society that we've made in entirely driven by consumerism in the last 50 years, and just completely flipping that on its head. Yeah, totally.
Exactly.
US job openings are down, but they are still well above their previous record highs recorded in 2018, 2019. And I don't really see much weakness in the US labor market, you know, that is going to justify a pivot from the Fed anytime soon.
No, and that's a very important number, actually. I think if you think about the argument as being very strong employment, that means that the economy is doing really well. If, in fact, the number of job openings are falling and you start to see changes in the employment landscape, that's a very important leading indicator of where maybe that's why the next numbers are going to be very important from the US, I think, coming out later on today.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Well, thank you very much once again. Tremendous conversation and very, very good slides. We'll put the links and things below, and we'll do it all again in a couple of weeks when there'll be a whole new lot of things to talk about, because things are moving so fast, aren't they?
Yeah, well, we'll have our updates on Kiwi housing prices. We'll have updates on more Canadian housing prices. There'll be plenty to talk about.
Tarek, thanks very much. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, mate.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.